Okay, so let's turn to your career at NASA in the astronaut office. You were selected in 1966, I believe.
That's correct. We were the fifth group.
Right. And from my notes here, you were selected as a backup to Apollo 8.
I was a backup to Apollo 8 with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. We were
Right.
the backup, on 8.
Okay. And of course, as soon as 8 left the pad, you were out of a job, as I've heard other people say. And
Right.
then you became the backup to Apollo 11, to Buzz,
That's
I take it.
correct. Unfortunately, Mike Collins got well.
Ah, okay.
See, Mike had had a neck injury, and he actually was pulled off of 8. He was on 8, and Jim Lovell, who was on the backup crew of 8, moved up to the prime crew.
Right,
And so Jim moved up to the prime crew, and that opened the slot that I took on 8. But then Mike got well, so with seniority, he moved into the prime slot on 11.
okay, so you were backup command module pilot on 8 then.
Yeah, so I was the backup then lunar module pilot to Buzz
Right.
on 11.
Okay. And then 11, of course, was a success, and you were assigned to Apollo 13. How soon after, when were you assigned to the lunar module pilot position for Apollo 13?
It wasn't long after 11. So actually, in our minds, we were going to fly 14. The
Okay.
crew cycle was normally 3 missions. If you back up to 8, you'd fly 11. If you back up to 11, you'd fly 14. And what happened was, I guess, the crew assigned, Al Shepard, Stu Roosa in particular, assigned with Ed Mitchell for 14 initially, had never gone through a training cycle. And so they decided that they would try to give them more time to train. So, see, they would have normally been 13.
Right, so they were
So
all rookies, right?
had been the backup on 10, which put him in line to fly 13. And they assigned those two new crew members because Gordon Cooper and Don Eiseley left the program, who had been the backup on 10 with Ed. So there were two new crew members. And so they asked Jim pretty soon. In fact, I think it was almost right after we went to the debriefing by Buzz and Neil and Mike, when they were still in the lunar recovery building. Then they always through a glass. They were in quarantine. They debriefed the mission, and I think Deke got Jim aside not long after that and asked him if he would move up, be willing to move up to fly 13, because we had all gone through. Well, I'd gone through two backups. Jim had flown one mission and gone through a backup, and Ken Mattingly had gone through one backup. So we were, let's call it, better trained to be able to do that. So he took the, it was always better to fly as soon as you can.
Absolutely.
So Jim took the opportunity.
So just on the crew formation, was it Jim's call to have you as his lunar module pilot and Ken as his command module pilot, or was that just simply the program and the astronaut office moving people as they saw fit for the roles?
I really can't tell you. It was obviously the commander got a chance to nod and said, but I really think the probably was an offering by Deke. You'd have to ask Jim Lovell, but I'm sure that what Deke would do is he'd have in mind people to cycle, and he would normally give the commander the courtesy of agreeing, or if he had a hard disagreement, of course. He probably went out. So it's kind of like offered to the commander to say, "Do you agree? This is who I'd like to, cycle in the rotation."
Well, so now we move to Apollo 13. The missions have been shuffled, and you're now in Apollo 13, prime crew, ready to go. Tell me about the lead up, the training, the sequence, how you found out, that sort of thing, that you were going to the moon.
Well, by being assigned to any mission from 11 on, you knew you were going to the moon. The main difference, I guess, in what we did in training, and I talked Jim into it and along with Jack Schmidt, we knew we were going to have more time to train. Things were pretty hurried up through 12. When I say time, I'm talking about mainly geology training. Just tough to get ready just to go fly it and think about getting back home. So we had more time because the schedules had slipped. For instance, 11, as you know, flew July. Pete Conrad and his gang flew in November, and we weren't going to fly to April. So what Jack had set up, Jack Schmidt, he had a professor at Caltech he had known, Lee Silver, and he arranged for Lee to give us, I'll call it a highly accelerated training in geology, field geology, and also employed one of his, I guess, graduate students, PhD budding students to help. And so we went into a pretty extensive, for the first time, any crew had spent that much time into geology training. So that was kind of the nuance, if you will, what we did in our training versus previous missions. And in fact, Jim thought it was a good idea. He had even less training than I had, at least as a rookie when I came in the program. I had quite a few geology field trips in my first year of training. Jim had very, very little at all. He was busy with Gemini flights. As a result, we followed up that way with Lee, and I think we became pretty good. We'd have done very well with that field geology work. In fact, Jim was influenced enough, as you know, on our patch. We did not have names. We had Ex Luna Scientia, you know, from the moon knowledge, science. And to that extent, in fact, we were the only two Apollo missions, at least, that had no names. Apollo 11 was one, and Apollo 13 was the other.
Yes. So yes. That first real focus on the science rather than just getting the engineering done of getting there and getting back alive type of thing.
Exactly.
Fantastic. So, so the launch date is set and you've trained as much as you can. And take me through the day, if you mind, the launch day.
Well, it actually, you'd have to go to about a week before launch. It was very emotional. Because that was the week where it became we all had been exposed to this measles.
Right.
Charlie Duke had taken his son to a birthday party, and he had been exposed. And of course, prime and backup crews are together every day in meetings, if nothing else. So we were all exposed, and so literally every day they took a blood sample. In the morning, and I understand it was shipped off, I think, to an expert in Cincinnati, Ohio. That was one of the world's experts on measles who evaluated our blood. And, you know, about midweek, it became apparent that Ken was suspect to come down with the measles because he was a bachelor. He had never had measles as a child. And so he had, I guess, zero antibodies in his blood. And there was a meeting with Deke. There was no flight surgeons involved, although their vote was to take Ken off. But the meeting we had was Jim and I met with Dr. Payne, who's the administrator of NASA, and Deke. And, flat told that their decision was Ken was going to have to not be able to fly the mission. Jim actually argued two things. One, maybe to slip him up. And just a quick discussion, and I knew that was not good from a reliability standpoint because we were so close. They had already opened the valves to the RCS thrusters on the service module. And in those, unlike shuttle, the seals and on those that equipment in those days could not have set a muff with that fluid wetted against the scales. So they had to pull the whole stack back to the VAB, and actually the only way to drain it would have been to cut the pipes, which would have been, and re-weld, which would have obviously been a concern about reliability to do all of that. So Jim argued to take Ken anyway because the incubation period for the measles, we would have got through the landing and had completed a rendezvous and would have been back in the command module to come home. And, you know, it's like, what a nice place to be in zero G, you know, not real comfortable. And they wouldn't buy it. So anyway, the crew change-out decision was made, and Jack replaced Ken, which was kind of unfair, obviously, to both. Ken was very, very disappointed, as anyone would be, at that late date when you've built up. Now it's finally going to happen. All this hard work, and now it's taken away. And it was unfair to Jack in a different way. Of course, he was, I'm sure, happy to get a chance to fly earlier. But same time, that late, he had made no plans for any visitors or guests to come to the launch.
Right.
Oh. We jokingly always kidded him. He couldn't invite his five girlfriends. But, you know, we also had a thing. We were allowed to fly a PPK, a personal preference kit. It was very small in size and very limited in weight, but I spent quite a bit of time canvassing friends and family to see what they personal thing they might want me to fly, but they had to be small and lightweight. Like my aunt wanted me to fly a rosary beads, and I told her it wouldn't work, so we took the crucifix off, and I just flew the crucifix, for instance. I flew another test pilot friend of Edwards' Mason ring. So, you know, you hit, and it took some time to canvas. And so, but now, unfortunately, a PPK was on board for Ken, and Jack didn't have that opportunity, you know, to go see what he might have taken for family and friends.
So it was that late. How many days before the launch was that decision made?
It was effectively, I guess, two and a half to 3 days. Wow. Yeah, launch. Now, literally, as far as I'm concerned, being a backup on 8 and 11 and then later 16, the way we trained in those days, it was pretty equal. So I suspect you could have almost changed out a crew the day before launch and it wouldn't have mattered. So we trained pretty much the same. In fact, if you looked at the records, probably a backup crew got a few more hours because the prime crew lost some days of training in a simulator or whatever. Because they had scheduled press conferences and those sort of things, that they lost training days, right. Whereas backup crew did not.
Fred, we'll talk a little bit more about the movie later on, if you wouldn't mind, but I just wouldn't mind asking you, did you have any concerns, you or Jim, any concerns about Jack's capabilities or competency before climbing on the rocket?
No, and alluding to the movie, that was, to me, a very unfair thing, because it gave that thought, we did go through critical phases like launch. We did a rendezvous, and we did an entry. We were actually in the simulator at about 8 o'clock the night before launch. And the main reason, though, was not procedurally. We all did it the same because we used the same checklist, the same books. We worried about how the verbiage was between the crew, and so we made a few runs of each of those type. To check that out, that backup crew hadn't devised a different way of discussing things. So that was the main reason we did that. Now, when Jack was very well versed in the command module, before he became an astronaut, his job at Rockwell was he was following the early development of the command and service module. He was a Rockwell test pilot and North American at that time, not Rockwell. And Jack also, when his support crew assignment on Apollo 7, had worked on developing the first set of what we call malfunction procedures for the command and service module, which was the only vehicle flown on Apollo 7. So he was very steeped in, again, malfunction procedures would be equivalent to emergency procedures. So he was very knowledgeable in that sense, which turned out to be good.
So the crew's set now. It's launch day. Tell me about that day and your thoughts and feelings on that.
Well, that was one, like I said, because of that build-up that week, I was kind of like half ready to go and half not ready to go because of that change-out. Again, not from the worrying about the mission success or all being able to perform, but just that aspect put a damper on things. I knew I had been the closeout crew member, one of the six. I was the astronaut closeout person on Apollo 8 and 9, so I was the last person out of the capsule on both 8 and 11. And you could tell that, you know, they were very excited, ready to go. Whereas I was kind of, I won't say I didn't have a little butterflies, but and excitement building, but I just wasn't as happy about things as I could have been that way.
Because of that crew change?
Because of that crew change, right. Yeah.
Okay. But you had full confidence in your own abilities and the hardware?
Oh, yeah. As far as that, technically, and able to do the mission, that was not a problem.
So you wake up in the morning, you get in your suit and off you go? Is that how it sort of works?
Well, no, you wake up and then you go to a breakfast. With the planned mission time, like I know for Apollo 8, which was planned to be a pretty short mission, they deliberately tried not to eat a lot. They went on to a sort of a diet, if you will, ahead of time, so hoping they could avoid having to go to the bathroom during their flight. So we ate a regular full breakfast, eggs and bacon and et cetera, had a regular full breakfast, and then went down to the room where you get into your suit and go through all of that with the instrumentation put on, and the suit then goes through a test. They test the suit with, hook you up to the consoles that are in there, and then you sit around a while till they call you to get moving to go out to the launch pad. Depends on, you know, how the countdown sequence is going as a plan times, but in ours turned out, I think the count went pretty normal, so we went out to the pad at about the normal time, and went up the tower and rode the elevator up and climbed aboard. I was the second guy to go aboard. Jim went aboard first, and then I went aboard to get in the right couch, and Jack came aboard last. And the head is all strapped in, and they said Gunnar Vent and his crew said goodbye and had closed the hatch, pressure checked it, leak checked it, and they departed. And we sat there, and I don't even remember how long it was, an hour and a half, 2 hours. Some length of time we were inside waiting to get through the terminal count to get airborne.
Right. So the weather was good that day and there was no delays?
No delay. No, we launched, as far as I know, to really right on time. The launch on a Saturn V, I guess the... I tell people, you know, it depends on your background how a launch would seem, and we had all been... pilots, fighter pilots. We had flown high-performance airplanes. We'd done air combat maneuvering, pulling, you know, 6-7 Gs, dogfighting, if you will, and stuff in training. So the G levels we knew we'd experience, 4.5 was peak on the Saturn V first stage, weren't that big a deal in that sense. The biggest thing I noticed about the Saturn V was it was very herky-jerky. And I, thinking back, this was kind of the start of the digital age, going from analog to digital. And I'm sure today, if they build a control system today, it might have been a little smoother. But when I say herky-jerky, when the engines gimbal to steer the rocket way up on top, and you were way up on top of that stack, maybe that exaggerated it too, you got a lot of jerking around in the capsule as the engines lurched. And it's a lot of thrust that's moving, too. I mean, it moved 4 engines of the 5, but that's 6 million pounds of thrust that's moving around with 4 of them.
Right.
So that was kind of the most unusual thing to me of the launch. You didn't hear a lot of sound, mostly damped somewhat by the airflow through your hoses to your suit. And pumps, you could hear the glycol pumps running, that kind of thing in the capsule. The second stage, of course, was smoother. Had 5 engines, but we're out of the atmosphere at that point. So it was a lot smoother ride on the second stage.
And by this time, the boost protective cover's off, and you've got a window to look out of.
Yeah, not initially. You can't look out until I don't remember what the time was now of the when Jim fired and got rid of the escape tower. When he fires away the escape tower, that clears your window view.
Right.
By that time, you're up and sort of already starting to cock over, so you can look out and see almost the horizon out there, which is quite a sight. The second stage, though, we had a problem. We had about 2 minutes before its runtime, the center engine shut down after a brief series of vibrations, which was POGO, where it had a fluid instability in the feed lines, actually changes the chamber pressure and the thrust levels to cause this little like riding a jackhammer for a very short time, and it went away. And it went away because the sensors detecting the drop in the chamber pressure of that center engine, where the structure was flexing to affect the pipe's feed enough that it shut itself down. It was an auto shutdown by design. Right. So the center engine shut down early. And it was a little concern because we knew it would take use a little more fuel now to get to orbit, because the second stage burned a little longer. And then the third stage, which completed your burn to get into orbit, also burned a little longer. But really, it wasn't very long. We got into orbit. That third stage had shut down then, that the ground had already made the calculations, and we were okay to use it again, the second burn, to what's called translunar injection to leave Earth orbit and head to the moon.
So was there something different with that particular launch that caused that problem on the second stage there, or was it just a manufacturing
issue? No, they had serious POGO on the second Saturn V launched, unmanned. It actually went through some pretty high gyrations, ended up almost diving in to get into orbit, and they thought they had it fixed with some accumulator tanks they add in to handle some of that fluctuation of the fluid flow, to damp it out. Now, they had slight flutter, I think, again, POGO on Apollo 8, very slight. And, of course, they kind of said, well, you know, they don't really understand it, and thought the fix, well, probably is all right. And, of course, ours got a little more serious. Accumulators apparently, for whatever reason, didn't do as good a job.
All right. Okay. So now you're in Earth orbit, and tick that milestone off, and you're on your way to the moon, or getting ready to go to the moon.
Yeah, we went around a couple of times. In the primary, that was done every flight, and the primary purpose was to allow time to check out all the systems on the spacecraft that you could, primary and backup, and verify that nothing had been damaged during launch. I'm talking about in the command and service module. Because a limb, you know, you weren't even hooked up to the limb yet. And so that was the main purpose of that exercise, to allow that, before you committed to leave Earth orbit, to at least make sure everything had survived launch and in good shape.
Right, so then everything's checked out and you head off to the moon. So firing the third stage?
The third stage was ignited again by people on the ground again. And Jim was, of course, monitored and actually could take over control and manually fly it if he had to, flying steering needles. As it turned out, all of that was done automated. And it shut down on time, so we were now breezing along at about 25,000 miles an hour, and at that time we got our helmets off and gloves off and didn't change positions. Jack took over the commander's seat, and Jim moved over in the center seat, and Jack separated, twisted a handle that separated the service module from the booster, and he just pulsed a little bit to move out a couple of hundred feet, and did a pitch turnaround to go back in and dock with the upper hatch of the landing craft, which he did. And we got the latches to fire, and got the two coupled together, and so we were pretty much home free. Then threw another switch to separate the limb from the third stage and did a little minor thrust maneuver to get clear. This was the first mission where the third stage, again, by people on the ground, was vented. That gave it some propulsive capability, and putting it in the right attitude, I guess, while it vented, steered it to impact the moon. So it was deliberately done, and I think it was done on all subsequent missions, because on each of the landing missions, we had placed seismometers. And so by impacting the moon, it allowed them to get some substrata data, much like they do on Earth for, I guess, mining and oil and gas exploration. Sure. To look at subsurface, see if there's anything good there.
Thanks, Fred. We'll take a break, and we'll return shortly with Fred Hayes from Apollo 13.